This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Book Waves, Art Waves programs on KPFA-FM and Pacifica Syndication. Alan First is known for his deeply researched atmospheric spy novels, all set in Europe in the period up to and including World War II. This interview was conducted on September 26, 2002, while he was on tour for his novel, Blood of Victory. His most recent novel, Under Occupation, was published in 2019. All his spy novels, most of which are standalone, are now known as the Night Soldiers series. Blood of Victory deals with the story of oil in Romania and getting oil in Romania to Nazi Germany. The book was originally titled Odessa. Was it a different book at the time?
Yes, it certainly was. My books start with nations. That's where I begin then. If I decide I want to write about Romania, or I decide I want to write about Poland, or I decide I want to set something in Hungary or France, this time I picked a nation that didn't actually exist physically. It was the nation of exile in Europe. And that meant Russian emigres who'd formed a kind of nation. Even though they didn't have a capital or a government, they virtually replaced those things. So the book was always going to be about Odessa, and it was eventually, I think, going to wind up in Odessa. But once the lead character goes to Odessa, he's going to be very hard to get back out, especially because he has, you know, run away, defected from the Soviet Union. While I was doing the research for that, I started to come across the stories that appear in Blood of Victory.
Which is the story of Romanian oil.
Yes. And the way that came about, I was reading a memoir by some British journalist, and there was a reference to the fact that, number one, the Brits had mounted two or three secret operations to stop the oil coming up the Danube, because if they did, there would have been no World War II. That's how major that was. There really would not have been a war, because the Germans could synthesize about as much oil as they needed for their air force. So their battle combat array would have been fighter planes and mules, because they wouldn't have had any gasoline for tanks, no petroleum products, no lubricants, nothing for the Navy, nothing for trucks. That's one reason they had the Blitzkrieg. They saved gas. You know, it was kind of the Japanese car battle plans.
So let me interrupt for a second. Does that mean, based upon what you're saying, that had France not capitulated but fought hard and not been overrun, they might have been able to stop Germany?
Oh, they certainly could have stopped Germany. What they should have done, when Churchill flew to France in, I guess, late May of 1940, he was going in order to make plans for France to fight on. They had an empire in Africa. They had armies in Africa. They had a navy. They had all kinds of stuff. They had a 5-million-man army. Now, much of their army was colonial anyhow. It was Vietnamese, then known as Annamese. It was Algerian. It was Moroccan. They had, you know, all Senegalese. They had all kinds of colonial regiments. And they could have fought on. Many of those regiments were based over in Africa. And they could have fought a war across the Mediterranean, based in Casablanca and Tangier. But they didn't. They just folded up and made peace with Germany. They didn't actually, well, they surrendered, basically, but they signed a treaty and they had a negotiation. But no, if France had fought on, I think the war might have ended right there. The real question, though, is would the United States have come into the war? Because it took the United States and the Soviet Union in the long run to beat Germany.
By that point, Germany had the oil. It had the resources because it had conquered all of Europe, or virtually all of Europe.
It did have the resources. Resources did become very scarce over time because in the war, much of the, you know, there was a lot of sabotage that was aimed at tank farms and petroleum transporters, and nothing's changed all that much. You know, you want to get the rail system, you want to get the canal system, which is, Red Gold is about the canal system. Nothing's changed all that much, but if France had fought on, it's interesting to project the war from that theoretical point. I'm not entirely sure what would have happened.
In Blood of Victory, there are scenes set in Istanbul, which of course you can go to and visit, but there's also scenes set in Bucharest. Bucharest at that point is a completely different city than exists today because Ceausescu destroyed most of Bucharest. How accurate is your Bucharest, and where do you get that information?
I get that information from all kinds of contemporary sources who talk, just as writers do now and journalists do now, about the city as it existed, assuming that everyone knew about it and that it would always exist. They had no idea that some monster would come along and destroy it in 40 years. They had no idea.
The International Russian Union, of which the writer, who's the protagonist, is a member. I was trying to figure out what the hell was it. Did it exist, number one? And number two, was it anti-Stalin? Was it pro-Stalin? It seemed to bounce around.
The International Russian Union, as written about, is an amalgam of two or three of the real emigre organizations that started to exist after 1917. Hundreds of thousands of Russians got out of the Soviet Union before it was too late, and they fetched up all across Europe. They lived in Berlin, they lived in Paris, they lived in Prague, they lived in Belgrade, and they lived in Istanbul. And they created these emigre organizations to try to care for their people one way or another. And the International Russian Union is not an extreme right organization. It's not white Russian. It's not a left organization. It's kind of a middle organization. Or as it says in the book, they had an ideology of Tolstoy, compassion, and sunsets.
And Serebin is kind of a takeoff on Isaac Babel, if Babel had gotten out?
Maybe somewhat. This is definitely a novel that is to some extent about the presence of Isaac Babel. And to that end, Serebin comes from Odessa. Like Babel and others, he's a writer, and he writes some of the same kinds of things that Babel wrote, which are these short pieces, such as you find in Babel's collection, Red Cavalry. In fact, there's a Babel story quoted in Blood of Victory.
Is that a real story?
It's a real story. And it was an unpublished story virtually at the time I found it because it appeared in a memoir. I thought, this is an amazing story. This is really good. And I determined that I would quote it. Yet, at the same time, Serebin is not Babel. He did not have Babel's enormous success. And he, unlike Babel, had managed to flee the Soviet Union in 1938. He got out while he could.
Well, you had said in our interview a year and a half ago that this may be one of the most documented periods in history. How accurate are the subtleties, like the weather? I mean, when Serebin is facing a blizzard, was there a blizzard that day?
No, I don't do that. I try to keep true to the weather in the sense that it follows the degree of severity that you would be liable to find in that European place at that time. But I try to stay very true to everything that I can stay true to. But I don't bother going out and finding out if there was a blizzard and if it was Thursday. I don't think it matters to the reader. I know that, you know, there were blizzards occasionally in big snowstorms in Bucharest during the period. That's all I need to know.
How about when Serebin travels and hits a border guard? Was there a border guard at that particular place?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Now that I do stay, I keep to that. For example, there was the last custom station and border area in that town short of Geneva. I can't think of the name of it now, but that's where you always had your border ceremonies, you know.
And in Istanbul, for instance, the hotel where he stayed at?
Fictitious.
In Bucharest, the hotel where he stayed at?
True. And described accurately based on books written during the period. I mean, down to the color of the walls.
Let's move over to the literature side of your book, and let me ask a question about your forebears, in particular, Eric Ambler. Did you read all of Ambler or most of Ambler before you began writing this series of
Absolutely.
Books?
Absolutely. I loved Eric Ambler. I thought I had such pleasure in those novels. First of all, they were like nothing else I read. Nothing. that I ever read. If there was someone else writing novels like that at the time, I didn't know about him then, and I don't now. Ambler's books, particularly Coffin for Demetrius.
That's a great book, great book.
What I think you see there is effectively, I can't say the invention because others have superseded him, but let us say this. There are not a lot of great European geopolitical spy novels before 1940, but there are some, and Ambler wrote 6 books, I think, of which 4 are really good, before 1940. Coffin for Demetrius came out in 1939, and that's a sophisticated geopolitical thriller, if you want to call it a thriller. I don't know how thrilling it is, but it has all the moves of contemporary genre fiction.
How did you stumble onto him?
I was, a library specter from my earliest youth, and I was always reading. I've read all kinds of things. I was the most eclectic reader in the world. I tried all kinds of things. I used to read in the stacks in college, just sit there and read novels. I mean, it was ideal.
And somehow you stumbled on him.
Yeah, I stumbled on Ambler. I also stumbled on, I'm just blocking the
Graham
name.
Greene?
Well, no. Graham Greene I had read also, but everybody read Graham Greene. Graham Greene was popular. But why can't I think of his name? He's André Malraux, excuse me, who wrote Man's Fate. He wrote 2 books, Man's Hope and Man's Fate. Man's Hope is the Spanish Civil War. But Man's Fate, the more popular one, was one of those kind of existential spy novels about 1922, about secret goings-on in Singapore. I think. Not Singapore, in Hong Kong.
Is it
Shanghai?
Is it possible to write a geopolitical spy novel today, or is it just too technological now?
I myself would find it too technological. And once you try to be authentic, you really begin to have problems. I know Dark Star is an attempt to write a spy novel that's really about spying. You know, it's a classic spy novel in that sense. Le Carré's spy novels are about moles, they're about defection, they're about love affairs. Dark Star is about actual spying, the obtaining of secret political information for political purposes, especially tactical information. And I don't think I'd ever try it again. The pages would fill up with initials. You know, when you would refer to the NKVD and you would refer to the Douzième Bureau and you would refer to the SD, you would refer to this one, that one, and the other one. And eventually I thought, no, this is impossible. No, I wouldn't try it. I wouldn't try a contemporary novel. Not unless I was very technologically interested, you know, that you have to be done Tom Clancy. Well, I mean, there's nothing that's good for Tom Clancy, but that's about what the novel of, you know, clandestine warfare has become right now.
As your books continue in this vein, they get shorter and they get leaner. What is happening in the writing of Alan First to make this happen, do you think?
Well, starting with The World at Night, I came down from panoramic novels. I didn't want to write another panoramic novel at that point. I wanted to write a neighborhood novel, so to speak. I mean, my neighborhood novels still take place in 3 countries, but I kind of redefined the way I was approaching this. I now like to say that I work on a large canvas in very fine detail, and I also work... I tend to sketch more now than I used to. I found that there are better ways of describing characters, faster ways, more meaningful ways. And the novels have changed in that way, although they've remained the same length since The World at Night. The shape of the books has changed, so there's in fact less pages to count. But there's, believe me, I know the lengths of the manuscripts. They're just the same length. They're all the same length. Thank you. But they seem leaner because they may read a little faster. Part of it is I'm just getting better at it. You know, as I've said before, I invented this genre, but then it took me a long time, like 3 books, to figure out how to work in it. Just because I invented it didn't mean I was good at it. It simply meant that I now had to figure out what it all, how it all was going to work. And it took me a couple of books to do that.
Question for you. In Polish Officer, there's a sequence fairly early in the book where the hero is on a train. And we feel the train with the hero as it goes south. How do you create that without actually being on the train? Because the detail is so perfect.
Thank you. That's my two-word answer. I don't know how. I mean, it happens. I somehow, first of all, I'm back there when I'm writing. How, I don't know how I do that. I am back there. I am not, if somebody comes and knocks at the door of my studio, you know, I'm startled. I go, ah, you know, I just go back there. I have a way of traveling back through time to that era. And now I can see the inside of the train. And I can tell you everything, the color of the floor, the fact that the seats are made out of yellow wicker, what that actually looks like. I can actually see it. The faces of the people, they're not American faces. The clothes they're wearing, they're not dressed from the Gap. On and on and on. The other thing that I think is important to the creation of this, to the, actually create a different time, you have to watch your language. Nobody ever says okay in my books. They can't. Basically, what you're reading with my characters is translated foreign language, and the foreign languages they speak are translated in different ways.
Sarah Vowell, who I interviewed recently from NPR, said she seemed astonished by your work because she said he must know Bulgarian. Is everything in English or, you know some French in those two languages? How do you deal with material from more obscure?
I don't know Bulgarian, and I don't know a word of Hungarian. I was in Hungary. I couldn't say yes. I couldn't say no. I couldn't say please, thank you, or pardon me. Hungarian's an impossible language. I didn't even try. But I did translate. You get a translation of one Hungarian poet and put that in Kingdom of Shadows because I felt so bad about writers, my brothers and sisters, writers, okay, who happened to write in a language that nobody could read and so could only be read in translation, except by, you know, natives of that country. I don't know how I do this. I'm just able to do it. I was born able to do it. It's just a funny thing to be able to do.
Alan First, you said last time you were here that one of the great joys of writing about that period is if you ever need to find a civil war, you just drop them somewhere. When you're, you know, and there's always a civil war going on somewhere.
That's true. Did I say that?
Something like that.
Yeah. But there was one in Romania in 1940. And when I do bookstores and read and talk and stuff, I say, did you know there was a civil war in Romania in 1940? And everybody looks at me. And I have to explain that this was a civil war between the kind of dreamy, idealistic fascists of the Iron Guard and the practical, everyday good guy fascists of the Antonescu regime. And they fought a war. But the way I get people to understand it is to say that it's the same as the brown shirts and the black shirts in Germany, which ended with the Night of Long Knives in 1934. Hitler killed all the brown shirts, but they were the more idealistic fascists than Hitler's guys who became the black shirts.
So Hitler just kind of watched these guys do it and eventually said, this is the side that I want to be on.
Right. He chose the practical side, as he had done in Germany in 1934.
Do you ever see yourself writing a novel that takes place during that time in Germany?
I'm considering that now. I'm not for my next book, which takes place in the Baltic, but for one after that, I've got vague notions about doing some stuff in Berlin. I've actually been reading about Berlin in the period, and it's quite different than perhaps you might think. I had to figure out, and I started doing it, how things worked in Berlin at that point, what kind of paper you needed, who was permitted to be there, what their story was. I mean, you'd almost have to write about journalists or military attachés or diplomats, because those generally are the last people in a country, and when they're thrown out, then you're probably going to be at war.
One thing I've noticed in reading five of your books is the main character has a certain similarity. Early 40s, womanizer, kind of apolitical, becomes political. The Polish officer was a little more political to begin with. And then the other characters are different. Do you see yourself writing a book where the main character is of a different sort?
No.
Why?
Well, basically, this is a series about the same character, except that it's different characters.
Really?
Yeah, exactly. No, this is a series hero. But you must understand there are certain constraints. I've never thought about attempting to write from a woman's point of view. I have very strong women characters. Women were at least 50% of the underworld clandestine life in Europe at this time.
Marie Celeste in Blood of Victory, for
She's
example.
She's a very tough, terrific woman. I really like that character. But as for 42... that's an age at which you know enough as to when to run, and you can still run. So it means that I can involve the hero in action scenes, but at the same time, my first book, Night Soldiers, the hero was 19 when we start, and that's a terrible mistake, because I had to write about a 19-year-old, and that's not the same. He's a rather mature 19-year-old. He grows up really fast, because it's a long book. But... No, the other thing about being 42 is that there you had a better chance of having survived the First World War. It meant that my character, Serabin, in Blood of Victory, it says at the very beginning of the book that this was his fifth war. And for a Russian male of age 42, fifth war is easy. His first war was he was a teenage artillery officer, a sub-lieutenant, in 1916, in World War I, at the age of 17. All quite logical. Then he fought, of necessity, on the Red Army side in the Civil War that followed the Revolution. That's two. Number three, having been a soldier, he's now recalled to fight in the Russo-Polish War, 1920-1922, and then as a successful journalist is sent to Spain in 1936 by, not Pravda, the other one.
But, Izvestia.
Izvestia, or I don't think it says, one of the newspapers, report on the Spanish Civil War. That's four. He's been in four wars. And now this is his fifth war, and he's not so sure he wants to get involved. For one thing, he doesn't have a country to fight for, which makes him a very interesting kind of character. Never have done this before. All my other characters are fighting for the home team, as we all do.
Could there ever be a chance, because they're so similar, maybe it's impossible to have two of your characters actually meet, or perhaps they have met and we don't know it?
Well, they have met and we don't know it. For instance, in Kingdom of Shadows, in the description of the physical presence of Nicholas Morath, he mentions having once met a French film director who said that he could play a chieftain or something like that. That's Casson. And in that paragraph, it's clear that that was Casson, although he's not mentioned by name. I think there's an impish part of me that wants to have all these guys show up at some community college in Maryland, you know, in the 50s, after the war. They've all been involved in clandestine stuff. They've all been brought to the USA and gotten these jobs, and here they meet at a cocktail party. No, but I'm never going to do that.
Well, Marie Celeste at some point, I believe, says that she's met the character who I suspect is the Polish officer.
No, she has met that person is younger. Her Pole
okay. is younger.
Is younger. No, she hasn't. But there's yet another character in that book who could be the Polish officer and isn't. Well, you know, it's like, how deep into these do you want to get? As deep as you want to get, I have stuff in there for you. And if you want to work your way down into it, it is there. I've hidden treasures all over the place. It's like burying time capsules. Most people don't want to read like that, and that's fine. You don't need to. But for those who do, and there are those, because they, you know, I've met them, and they've written to me, there's stuff there for them.
Alan First, now out of the blue and after being around writing several novels, you're suddenly this big success. Has Hollywood come to call?
I have two books in option right now, one with a group in London and a second one, World at Night, with somebody on the West Coast. Those are two very serious options. Will a movie be eventually made? You would have to be Nostradamus plus have to say, in order to know something like that. It's very difficult to make that call. There's been great interest, but at the same time, you know, they will tell you, well, there's no American hero. And I say, does a movie have to have an American hero contemporaneously? Apparently it does, but we'll see.
Now, you've been kind of lucky in that your earlier works, the five novels previous to Kingdom of Shadows, have all in the past year and a half been reissued in trade paperback. And I've been slowly working my way through them. And we began by talking about a book that came out several years ago, again, available right now in trade paper, called The World at Night and its sequel, Red Gold. And I mentioned that The World at Night was very different from Kingdom of Shadows, Blood of Victory, and The Polish Officer, because it takes place in Paris, and you know Paris.
Yes, well, I lived there for a long time. I didn't intend to have Red Gold, in fact, be a sequel to The World at Night. The opening quote in Red Gold is from Victor Serge, and what I wanted to do with that book is have a Victor Serge character, which is to say the 1940 Trotskyite, bruised, battered, loathed, driven from Spain, driven here, driven there, no country to go to, and he was to be the central character. But The World at Night was in a number of ways as successful, not so much as Kingdom of Shadows, but it was quite successful and quite well reviewed. And there was some feeling at my publisher that the lead character, Jean Casson, who was a French film producer, was a good character and maybe ought to reappear. And so I tried it. And then in the end, I was not entirely happy that I'd done it. But that book gave me trouble anyhow. I think every writer in their career has a book that gives them trouble. Red Gold gave me nothing but fits.
Why?
Well, first of all, I had to do all the research in French. And here's the reason. Red Gold is about the fact that there was no French resistance until the French Communist Party came along. At the end of the war in 1945, there was very nearly a brutal civil war in France between the left and the right. It was just barely avoided, and thankfully avoided, because if the country was pretty badly screwed up, it would have been worse. So we then enter in the period of the Cold War. Meanwhile, the guys from the French Communist Party write their memoirs, especially the intelligence service of the French Communist Party, believe it or not, because they had one, and it was quite good and quite effective and was very prominent in the resistance. However, because I think of the Cold War, those books were never translated. So I had to go find them in French, buy them from France, have them sent to me, and do the research in that way. It was very, very curious. So that book started difficult, and it stayed difficult. I like the book. I think it's not so bad. But it did give me a harder time than some of the others.
Well, having read Red Gold a month after rather than a year and a half after, which is when it came out, I was able to see it at more as a piece, parts one and two of the same book. And to that degree, it works. Because the first, it's really a single story. It's the story of this one man's fight to come to grips with going from being an outsider and a bystander to being involved in the war.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And by the way, tells the story of collaboration and resistance in France, which is a complicated story.
He has his ex-wife, her husband, is a collaborator.
Absolutely.
With the Nazis. And when we hear today about that, we hear nothing of the collaborators, except occasionally a novel will come out. It's a mystery novel by Cara Black, which was about collaborationists getting their just rewards 20 years after the fact. But other than that, we don't hear anything about it.
Well, that's because collaboration in France was a thing of fine degree. In The World at Night, Casson has lunch with his lawyer when he finally returns to Paris after serving in the military at the age of 42. And he says to his lawyer, well, what? He's a film producer. And he says, well, what am I supposed to do now? And the lawyer says to him, well, under occupation, what will your barber do? And Casson says, well, he'll cut hair. And his lawyer says, well, does that mean he's collaborating? And Casson thinks about it, and he says, well, I guess not. He says, no, writers will write novels. Producers will produce movies. Do you know who did your show? your show, under collaboration? This show, virtually, the cultural show in Paris in 1942 and 1943, the host was Simone de Beauvoir.
During the occupation?
Yes, absolutely. Camus' novel came out in 1942, The Stranger. In fact, the producer in The World at Night wants to buy it for the title. He likes the idea, L'Étranger. He sees it on a movie marquee. No, the French collaborated to a great degree, but they also, the other side of their nature, very unfortunately, because I think someone writing about it says that at the end of the war, they opened warehouses that the Gestapo had kept while they were in Paris and came upon what they described as mountains of denunciation. In other words, unopened, some of them, piles of letters that reached 15 feet in this huge warehouse as far as the eye could see. I mean, it was, they didn't do well. They broke, shall we say. They lost their soul by not fighting back.
But it's clear. You can see the transition, and this was one of the reasons why I call it more of a single novel, even though one might have been easy to write and one might have been hard and they were written apart. You see over the course of the two books the way collaboration takes your soul, and the way, as it comes out in the second book, it becomes more clear, where it's not really in the first, that the Nazi occupation is going to last indefinitely. We know it was over in 4 years. They didn't know that. For them, it could have been 20 years. So when you see the factory owner in the book who doesn't like the Nazis, and yet he's got a factory that's aiding the Nazis, what do you do?
What do you do? And furthermore, I think you really have to understand people in that era. The penalty for being in the resistance was very severe. And they weren't fooling around at all. They would catch you. They were quite capable of catching people and caught them all the time. There was no so-called marquee early in the war. That came after the Battle of Stalingrad, because what happened was, after Germany lost an army at Stalingrad and effectively lost the war, they had a manpower crisis. And so they started to draft French civilians into war work in Germany, and a lot of them wouldn't go. So they went out into the countryside, the brush, in French, marquee, and so the legend, shall we say, or the myth of that particular part of the resistance begins to play a part. Now, frankly, by 1944, when it was clear who was going to win the war, the French were right there, and they were all armed, and they were all ready to go.
Of course, it's a different time, and you know, you always go with a winner. Look,
well, they did.
You know?
They did. And the French had a name for them. They called them Naphtaline, which means mothballs.
That brings us in a roundabout way to the topic in Blood of Victory, because it raises the question, which is something that it's kind of been toying in the back of my head for a long time, and I've never quite understood this. Here was this one country, Germany. Not only does it conquer, and we know countries conquer, we see it happen all the time, but somehow through conquering, they're able to hold on to this empire for 4 years. How did they do it? How did they manage to do it when no one outside of Austria really wanted them there? Yet they somehow managed to do it. Now, obviously, they needed oil, which is where Blood of Victory comes in, but something else must have been going on.
Well, first of all, you had a lot of fascists in Europe in that period, so that in countries like Norway and other, you know, France, you had willing fascists who would take over a puppet government. The only country in Europe that never had a puppet government was Poland. The Nazis governed Poland directly. They did not govern France directly. Vichy governed France. And in Norway, the Quisling individuals governed Norway. These people thought that the German or fascist domination of Europe would last for 300 years. After all, they were very familiar with 300-year empires. They were pretty common in 1940. The German Empire, the Russian Empire, and the Ottoman Empire had all died in 1918, but that's in recent memory in 1940. That's 22 years earlier. You know, for us, we're talking about 1978. That's the equivalent. So 300-year empires were nothing to them, and the British Empire still existed and did well, and now there was going to be a new German empire. So they had no reason to think that in their own lifetime they would ever have to account for their behavior. They thought they were smart. We're going to go with the Germans here, and we're going to run the government of this country, and we're going to do what's right. Pétain in France believed that the French, by being immoral, having love affairs and drinking wine, had weakened themselves, and had weakened themselves to the point of losing that war, and now needed to be morally rebuilt as a nation so they could be triumphant and once again have an empire, which they had.
But that would mean that France would be under German control and maintain, you know, secondary status to Germany. It's kind of a curious, it's a dichotomy there. I mean, that they're going to rise, but they can't rise because Germany really controls them.
Well, their German friends helped them. Why is this less of an alliance than any diplomatic alliance in the world today? The people in Vichy were sorry they'd lost the war, but they were responsible for it, or the French were responsible for it, or the communists were responsible for it. And the only nation that stood up against Bolshevism was Germany, and Germany sold itself on that basis all the time, and it's in all my books. That's how they did this thing.
But that opens up something that happens in Blood of Victory. A major part of the book is, if Germany stood up against Bolshevism, you've got that curious phenomenon, which lasted, I think, a year, of the Stalin-Hitler peace pact.
Right.
Now, from the perspective of communists in America, the moment that happened, I know of a number of communists who said, to hell with it, and they walked away from the party at that moment.
Right.
But over there, how could it be dealt with? I know that your character, Sarabin, in Blood of Victory, is kind of bemused by it, but he has no illusions about Stalin. But throughout Western Europe, the Communist Party must have.
They felt in the Communist Party, the ones who stayed, that you were fooling yourself if you believed that anything with compassion could overcome Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler required an equally brutal force on the other end to defeat him, and that was, as we called him in America, Uncle Joe Stalin, that great guy who had already slaughtered 40 million people before the war started. But he was then our ally.
But in that, there was a period when he made peace with Germany.
They made a peace of realpolitik as the two despised nations in Europe, as the two nations in Europe run by thugs who'd never gone to college, who were not part of the ruling class. You have to remember that both Hitler and Stalin came from the street, and that was totally different than any other leader in Europe at that time. The rest of them were all aristocrats one way or another, including in Britain.
So, and that's an aspect that we don't hear much about.
No, I don't think we hear much about it, because the politics of the period had people changing sides. And nobody had any illusions in Germany about the Russians, but they needed stuff that Russia had. They needed, one of the things Russia had they needed was oil. And the Russians needed German know-how, engineering, help with this and that and the other. Plus, they also had a secret agreement. Aside from the pact on the surface, which basically under which they took Poland and divided it in half, they also had pacts starting in the middle of the 1930s. Now, under the Versailles Treaty, Germany was not allowed to have an air force. So they had air clubs, but they also had an air force people training in Russia. And they had tank people training in Russia. That's the way the treaty, I think it was Rapallo, specified. They had all kinds of things going on together, those two countries. They were in their way, they managed to get along quite well.
Alan, first, let's talk more specifically about some of the events in Blood of Victory.
Okay.
Now, I understand from a review, I haven't read all of your books. Or maybe my memory is lacking, but apparently one of the characters in Blood of Victory was a character from another book.
That's correct.
Which one is that?
That is a Hungarian former diplomat named Polanyi, who in Kingdom of Shadows was the eminence grise who directed the hero of that book to do all the things that were done in Kingdom of Shadows.
Kostika.
Yes.
Baron Kostika is an interesting character. Was there actually an industrialist who surreptitiously joined kind of the European resistance while keeping up his contacts like that?
I think there were a number of such people, including Germans, but doing it from Switzerland. But he is based in part, and his history is most assuredly based on the famous arms dealer Basil Zaharoff. And I might have used Zaharoff himself, except that he died in 1936. And I wanted it to be a fictional character because of some of the things he does later in the book. He has to be a fictional character. But his history is Zaharoff's history. And I mentioned Zaharoff in the same chapter. And the chapter is called System Z, so it's not like it's a big secret. I'm saying to my reader, if the reader is a historian, look at, it's Basil Zaharoff. Yes, you're absolutely right. That's who it is. I'm going to acknowledge it right here on page 232. However, we're using his biography. This is a historical novel. You know, it's fiction. You can do what you want. We're using his biography for another character. We hope he doesn't mind.
Alan, first, you've got Blood of Victory. You said your next book is taking place in the Baltics.
Yeah. I can't say very much about it because I'm not really that far down the road in terms of the research, but I have a pretty good idea of where and when and what's going to happen.
Do you do most of your research before you write the book then?
I do it. That's a really good question. I do my research in three sections. Number one, I've done a lot of research so that each book I write, I learn more about places and people, and I become interested in certain aspects. This period was so huge, involved so many millions of people, generated thousands of stories. You can't begin to know them all, so I gradually learn them. So that's one part of research. Then I get interested in a country, and I start reading about the country, and I start reading about the history of the country, and then I take a time period, and I start seeing what happened to that country in that time. And I get into about 3 or 4 months and I think, well, good, I've done all the research. No way. I have to continue to do it because it very often happens that I will discover things unbelievably late. I mean, I did a lot of the oil research just as I began the book. And one thing I might as well say is I found at that point a speech by a French senator made in 1918, just after the armistice, at a petroleum conference, where he stood up and said, oil, the blood of the earth, has become, in time of war, the blood of victory. And I thought, well, I'm going to have to call the book that, because it has such a contemporary resonance for us, and having oil be the center of wars one way or another.
You've been listening to an interview with spy novelist Alan Furst, recorded September 26, 2002 in the KPFA studios while he was on tour for his novel Blood of Victory, part of his Night Soldiers series of mostly standalone novels. His most recent novel, Under Occupation, was published in 2019. Until next time, I'm Rich Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write to me either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky Radio Shows on Facebook.